Coffee Time Wednesdays with the Prairie Farm Podcast.
Can't hit us with the jingle.
Welcome back to the Prairie Farm Podcast, the Coffee Time Wednesday, the best 15 minutes of your life, of your week at least. We are, I think, recording the earliest podcast that we've ever recorded.
Yeah, probably so.
Before 7 a.m., we're hanging out. Kent and I are traveling to Illinois, staying at the famous Alan Boucher's house. Thank you for having us.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
Yeah. And we figure we'd just record a Coffee Time Wednesday for you. It's too early to have any clever intro. Kent, what do you got?
Well, it's good to be back home in a sense. This isn't the house I grew up in, of course, but, you know, just in this area. I love where I live now. It's fun being on the family farm, but I get homesick for this area often. I miss the community here. And, I think it's, mostly a testament to the people, but, it's also, just a reflection of the natural beauty in this area too. So, you commented on this yesterday, Nicholas, as we were driving, just how much diversity there was on the landscape in this part of Illinois.
Yeah.
And really we're kind of up the hill from the Mississippi, floodplain. So we would be in a, you know, if you were to wind back time a couple hundred years, we would be in a riparian, you know, mixed forest and prairie area right here. Mm. And I'm guessing the spot where we sit now would probably have been forested. But, you know, looking out around us, there would have definitely been prairie too, I would imagine, at one time.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine clearing trees back then to put a homestead or you know, that would have been so hard. Think about like taking 5 years to do that.
Yeah. So Dad, you've had a interesting career where you've been a school administrator for how many years?
Well, if you exclude my time at a youth home, I would say it's about 28 years.
Wow. And
he's famous for, he physically wrestles the kids down to the ground when they're not behaving. He gets them, you know.
I don't think you've ever had to do that, have you?
No, I have to get trained twice a year to be able to do the physical restraints for the students because they want to make sure we do it correctly. But to be honest with you, I haven't had to do that yet in my job. There are usually some younger and more capable people who have taken care of all of that.
Ah, but I feel like you're not even allowed to touch a student anymore, even in a safer, restraining, carry them out of the classroom way.
Yes, we are told that by and large, you're not allowed to touch the students unless they are a harm to themselves or someone else. But if they're destroying property, you're not allowed to touch them. If they're just trying to leave the premises, you're not allowed to touch them, only when there's going to be physical harm involved.
Hmm. Man. So when you're teaching, What is the biggest takeaway you have from the students that in your life, and you know, you're learning from these younger humans? And I know you're not teaching, you're actually an administrator. What is one of your biggest takeaways?
Well, I think most recently when I've worked with troubled youth, I've found that they aren't really motivated by incentives very much. I thought that, oh boy, you just got to come up with a good incentive and they'll work hard for it. Hmm. And I found that that's not true. And I found that consequences don't really work either, because a lot of these kids, they don't care about consequences and they don't care about incentives. They really just want to do what they want to do. Hmm. And if you allow them to do what they want to do, then generally they don't cause you problems. But that's what I've learned most recently.
Man, so that's tough, because you can't control another human being into doing what you want them to do or even what you think would be best for them. I think about that all the time. I cannot control someone even for their better, you know. Wouldn't the world just be better if everyone listened to me and did what I said? But yeah. So
How do you handle that internally, watching these, you know, maybe not making the best decisions, but they're not destroying property, they're not hurting each other, I guess I'll just let you.
Well, you want them to improve, you want them to grow, and over time you do see that a lot of these students do grow, but it's mainly because of your relationship with them and because of their natural maturation. In other words, they grow up. And so they usually come in pretty, you know, in the junior high, pretty squirrely. They act out. They are impulsive. They're very physically active. And they love the shock factor, you know, doing things that, you know, you didn't think they would do. And over time, they listen maybe to what you're trying to teach them. But overall, you give them the best speech of your life, and you find out that they weren't even paying attention. Hmm. And so that can be discouraging, but you have to look at it from the long view, that over time, over years, hopefully they'll show improvement. And then at one point, they'll be self-motivated to be productive and be functional and to get along the way they should.
Hmm. Man, that is a hard job, working with troubled youths.
Another interesting thing about your career, Dad, is, you know, and sorry, everyone, if you can hear my kids in the background here.
And no need to apologize for kids. People understand.
But another interesting thing is you've had to, as a superintendent, be involved in infrastructure planning for your districts and so forth. And one of those things is a giant wind turbine. It was a kind of a project you inherited. Can you tell us what, I mean, you've got a pretty good idea what goes into maintaining one of those things now, and the payoffs and trade-offs and all that stuff. Could you talk about some of your experiences with that?
Yes. In 2008, our school district installed a wind turbine. There are only four districts in the state of Illinois that have wind turbines, and so that in itself gives a message, and that is that they're not very successful, or most school districts would have one. And it's been basically a disaster since day one.
oh, no. What does disaster mean?
Disaster means it's supposed to have saved us a couple of million dollars over the life of the turbine from the energy savings. However, I think that when all is said and done, when they finally take the thing back down, it will have cost the district an additional $2 or $3 million. So we would have been better off never having the turbine. And, you know, I personally believe that's true with all wind turbine farms, because those pieces of equipment cost so much money to manufacture, to transport, to install, and then to maintain, that I just can't imagine the energy savings overtakes that.
Yeah, I think part of the idea is that there wasn't infrastructure for the wind energy marketplace. So the government tried to help build the infrastructure by giving huge subsidies and huge grants and huge loans to help establish these things. And I don't know, you know, maybe it takes decades longer than I'm thinking, but my understanding is they're not, at this point in time, they're not that efficient. If anything, they might be negatively efficient. But I looked up yesterday, Illinois is the number one state for wind energy output. That's just an overall gross number. I don't know per turbine, I don't know per, you know, square mile, but overall they produce the most wind energy and the most nuclear energy. Your school's not putting in like a nuclear power plant right next to it, is it?
No, we don't have that underway yet.
Oh, okay. All right. Well,
there is one in this area, though, Exelon, which I was thinking, Nicholas, we should have asked a friend of mine who is his official title is environmental chemist, who works at Exelon.
Oh,
and he has an incredible... So next year, we'll try and get Mr. Jeremiah Haas on the podcast. But the thing about wind energy is you get the turbine up, it's going to, you know, convert wind energy into electrical energy. You're going to get that conversion.
Yeah.
But as my dad was saying, the amount of work that first of all goes into manufacturing the components, the amount of energy that goes into hauling all those components to that location. I mean, think about how many it takes one way oversized load to move one blade
yeah.
on those things. And then that has to have two or three pilot cars with it going down the interstate and highways to make sure there's a clear path through everything. And then you got all the other rest of the sections, you know, that make up the tower that lifts up the motor and the blades and all that. You know, I imagine it's probably, and then you factor in all the laying down the concrete and the rock underneath. I mean, I got to imagine it's probably over a dozen semi trips just to get the thing, all the stuff there, you know, and then, but then also the maintenance. I mean, that thing, the one you were talking about, Dad, has spent a lot of its time not even functioning, right?
Right. Because early on, we contracted with a company to do the regular maintenance, and that maintenance is very important. And that company did not, complete those maintenance tasks. And so without us knowing, that turbine became very vulnerable to a malfunction. And sure enough, one day it was spinning out of control, and the devices that were supposed to keep it under control weren't working because of that lack of maintenance. And so then it's supposed to have a maximum a spin of about 35 rotations a minute, and it was up to 55. And so we had to have a maintenance guy who knew nothing about turbines climb all the way to the top and throw a safety pin through one of the rotors or something to make it stop. And then it sat for 2 years because we couldn't get a company to come out and repair it, and there were massive failures within it. And so,
why couldn't you get a company to come out?
Because they have a hard time keeping those wind farms going, because there might be 100 turbines on one wind farm, and they have a whole crew that just goes from turbine to turbine doing maintenance and repairs. The last thing they want to do is come out and help you at a school district for one turbine.
Yeah.
So they're willing to if they have time. Well, they never have time. And so a lot of times when you call for a simple project, they'll take 6 weeks just to come out and take a look at it, and they'll find out what the problem is. Then they have to order parts. Then they have to wait for a time they're free again to come out and make the repair. So you know, your turbine might be down. Well, there for many years, the turbine was down at least half the year because of, you know, not because they were complicated problems, just because we couldn't get anyone to come out and work on it. And so while the thing's not spinning, you're not making electricity, so you're not getting the savings that was promised.
Yeah.
You know, in the beginning, and it becomes very, very frustrating. And then one time we had a company that wasn't associated with the manufacturer. And so the manufacturer was very stubborn about giving their parts to outsiders. And so this outside company had a terrible time getting parts to repair it. And so they would have to go to India to find the parts. Then they'd have to be shipped to America. And then you have all that duty and all that stuff that you have to go through just to get them in the country, and then they could make the repairs. So, as I said at the beginning, it was nothing and continues to be nothing but a disaster. It should be a good thing. It should be a source of community pride, but it's not. It's a disaster.
Well, I have a friend whose dad was putting one up on the farm. You know, he did the math with the salesman, I'm sure, and said, oh, this math's out. Well, they get it put up, never turned on. That company that put it up went bankrupt, but he had already paid the full amount, never got turned on, and eventually it just came down. That was what happened with that, you know, I'm sure tens of thousands of dollar project.
Yeah. And, you know, as we wind this one down, you know, what's the lesson here? You know, I always try to come up with a lesson because I was a former teacher, but, first of all, I think it's encouraging that we have other avenues on the horizon, especially solar energy. I think that has the potential to be a much lower maintenance option. You know, you don't, anytime you have moving components, you have heavy maintenance costs, you know, whether it's just greasing bearings or it's taking the whole thing apart and putting in and rebuilding it. But for a panel, obviously there can be some rotation there to take the, you know, capture the best angle of sunlight throughout the day, but by and large, pretty simple construction. And so I'm excited to see where solar goes. Of course, we also have, you know, more battery powered things. I think our battery manufacturing needs to get a lot cleaner and a lot more capable for storing for longer amounts of time before that mm-hmm. really starts to get ahead on the efficiency. My daughter has some thoughts as well, apparently. We also can look at some of the old ways that we've been able to convert energy into usable forms for us. And I think nuclear, Nicholas has talked about this quite a bit, continues to be a really, obviously there's some high risks there in the worst case scenarios, but in most cases, those worst cases are not going to happen.
Yeah, I solved the nuclear problem or the energy crisis, and Elon, and no one's listening.
He's still waiting to get back to your email.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure it'll just a day or two more. Alan, my ideas just have an obscene amount of nuclear power plants on the moon. And just ship batteries back and forth, recharge them out there, and then and the power sure, you need.
I'm sure that the we wouldn't have to worry about emissions because they're all happening in space.
Yeah, yep, exactly. See, that's exactly what I'm saying. And there wouldn't be emissions because they'd be run on battery, powered by a nuclear power plant.
You're using batteries to get back to Earth.
Yeah.
With more batteries.
So it takes 8 batteries to get back with 1 battery.
Oh, I should add that I do think that wind has a place in the future for energy because cars, when they first came out, had wooden spokes. They had very low horsepower. They were not reliable. There were all kinds of problems with automobiles when they first came out. However, they stuck with it. They had innovation. And now, all these years later, cars are an invaluable tool for us. And I think the wind farms are in their infancy still. So yeah. Maybe with innovation, with new ideas and new ways of going about it, that wind can still have a place. It's just that it's in that early stages like the automobiles were in 1900. And hopefully we'll be able to transition to a better place.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, you know, having a diversified energy portfolio as not just a country, but as a planet, you know, is going to be the way forward.
I was telling Kent the other day, I think it'd be really cool if each power company created power with different avenues, but then you could buy which power you wanted. You know, come in on the same power line, but you would say, hey, I want my energy to come from wind. And honestly, frankly, the exact electrons that you get might not come from the wind energy, but it would mean, let's say they have 60% of their people say, hey, I want my power to come from wind. Even if it's more expensive, they could give a layout. Hey, this is how much wind energy is going to cost. This is how much fossil fuel energy. This is how much nuclear energy is going to cost. You know, they have it laid out. You say, this is the one that I want. Because it gives, frankly, the middle class and upper middle class and upper class, it gives them the option to pick the higher choices without crapping on the poor people. You know, if you tripled the energy cost because we decided everything was going to be solar and wind, well, the people who actually hurt are the bottom 40% who are living paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea, and it allows people who do see value beyond the dollar to pay for that value.
Yeah, awesome. Well, this has been a really good time talking about energy. We didn't talk about coffee at all this morning, which is astounding.
But I'm drinking coffee because it's an early morning podcast.
Yes. And if Kent was at home and not his parents, he'd be drinking Wild Rivers.
That's right.
Wild yeah. Rivers coffee.
Which, I should have brought it along with me. But that's all right. I have something to look forward to when I get home. I got the Guatemalan roast, which has the I can't remember. I think it's actually a grizzly bear on the bag. And I do not know of any grizzly bear conservation advocacy groups, but there could be one out there.
Save the bears.
But
they need saving. They had the worst, some of the worst years they've had in a while.
Well, grizzlies, I think, are doing okay. But
talking about those Chicago bears.
Oh, there's no, yeah. There's no saving there. Dude, that's that's just a steep path to extinction.
It's like a donation to the Chicago Bears Fund.
Please get better.
Yeah. No, but they are doing an amazing thing. You guys have heard it before, but please check them out. Their website's in our description. It's a really good way you can support us, support them. They're really cool people, and support really good causes in conservation.
Yeah, the Guatemalan Rose supports backcountry hunters and anglers, which is a great conservation-minded group. It's not the only thing that they're working on, but it is certainly a big part of it. And something that is important to myself and most other hunters out there is their advocacy work on maintaining access to our public lands. And I think when people are able to go and experience nature in a way like you can when you go hunting and fishing and trapping and other things, I think that's when you can really build those deeper connections to our natural places and develop the heartbeat of a conservationist.
Hmm. Well, this has been fun. Thanks so much for hanging out, Mr. Alan Boucher.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been a pleasure. It's Friday, you know.
It's Friday.
That's right.
Thanks for hanging out with us, little Helena. That's Kent's youngest, soon to be second to youngest. And everyone, we'll see you next week.
Thanks, Dad.